Talk given Sunday, 18th May, 1980. The universal constant life, life in the sense in which it is meant in the Chandogya Upanishad when they say Brahman is life, the absolute all is life, prana. This life gives rise to birth, jati as we call it, a conditioned state. And as soon as there is a conditioned state, the process of disintegration starts. And then life itself, this universal life, brings about death, marana, in due time. The time taken by this alternating pulse of birth and death we call the lifetime of the individual. The apparatus for manifesting this alternating pulse is the living person, the bhuto or puggala. I think both words can be used. The psychophysical structure, as we would say in our modern terms. Structure can be inert, like a stone, a lump of metal, a machine, a piece of dry wood, and so on. But it is never lifeless in an absolute sense, because every atom constituting that structure is vibrating. This thrilling is life, a response by or a demonstration of consciousness. There is no such thing as dead matter, and I think modern science now has come around to that viewpoint. There is no such thing as dead matter. There is constant interaction going on way down into the subatomic world. And the new particles which are formed by this interaction between the subatomic particles. Every particle of the subatomic world is active, therefore, alive, creative, because it gives rise to new and different particles. The word particle is a bad word, actually, in this context, because the word, the meaning we give to the word particle is through our ordinary experience of a solid particle, which is substantial, which has resistance, which has mass. But these particles do not display any of those qualities, apart perhaps from mass in some instances, though not in every instance. In any structure or object in the inert or non-moving state, there are countless pulsations spread over an extended period of time. This is the lifetime of that object, and it can be, and very often is, much longer than the lifetime of living creatures. When the object completely disintegrates, it is truly dead, as we would say. But all of its substance is changed into other forms of matter, still alive and active, for the atoms of this other kind of matter are ceaselessly vibrating. And if it is not changed into other kinds of matter, it is transformed into energy, light, heat, and so on. And the conservation of mass and energy is the law of the conservation is observed. There is nothing lost. There is nothing gained either. There is the, as it was in the beginning, so to say, is now and shall remain as such. the cosmic dance of Shiva has no beginning nor ending. It is creative action in eternity. Structure or body displays a life-death alternating pulse. But life function is everlasting. So let us rather say life, other life, rather than life death. Though we may rightly say birth death, for birth and death are held within the confines of time and enclosed in the sphere of mortality. As living structures, our psychophysical existence has two intimately intertwined aspects. This touches us human beings particularly. First, the little life pulses of each atom of the body and of each vibration of the psyche spread through the second aspect, which is the lifetime of the individual, consisting of X years between conception and death, the death of the organism. So that we have this sort of dual type of existence. One which is concerned with the very short pulse of the atoms composing us and of every psychical response to every single sense impression that we receive. That has a very short lifespan. The lifespan of the concrete atoms themselves composing the body is the shortest of all. The shortest wave, so to say. And the psyche, with the psychical life, it is a somewhat longer wave. And with our whole life as such, as the living organism, the particular person, that is usually the longest. Well, in every case, that is the longest wave that there is. The I am I consciousness, characterizing the second aspect, the isolative self-consciousness, maintains itself throughout our bodily lifetime. And it maintains itself by clinging to each and every life pulse of the first aspect, namely the bodily and the psychical, the response to the reaction to every sense impression. And this is the basic meaning of tanha, this clinging to all that the psychophysical organism displays in terms of action and reaction to both internal and external. This is tanha, and this clinging to and conscious self-association with each life pulse in succession during the lifetime of the body is the only sensible meaning of our past lives in the reincarnational sense. See, with every single response to the sense impressions and to the bodily processes as such, we associate ourselves. The I am I associates itself with that particular response or experience or whatever it may be. And whilst it lasts, that is your particular life at that period. So it is during the lifetime of the body itself, the whole life, from conception to death, that the succession of lives takes place. And when a person who has developed the capacity through the practice of mindfulness and so forth, develop the capacity to be able to trace back these lives, as we may call them, he talks of them as his past habitations. The habitation of the I am I consciousness, that is me, that was me going through that experience, and so on and so on. Which in a sense is somewhat like the association technique of the psychologist. But there is some considerable difference between the association technique of the psychologist and this looking into the past lives, as we call them. In the Heart of Religion, towards the end, in the chapter on meditation, you will find a certain amount which has been written on this subject. On the death of the organism, our lifespan is ended by life, the universal power. That is the power that really ends our life if we let nature take its course, as we call it. Otherwise, if we do something wrong, like suicide, or if somebody murders us, or an explosion or an accident takes place, then we can hardly say that the supreme life power has put an end to our life. But if it happens naturally and in due course, in the proper way, then this is the meaning perhaps of the term kalam karoti. Literally it means he does his time, or he has done his time. If anybody has been to jail, it might have rather unpleasant associations, the meaning of kalam karoti. When the life span is over, our I am I consciousness vanishes altogether. This I am I consciousness comes into being only after we are born, because other people around us tell us that you are so and so, and they say I am so and so. So the words you and I, denoting the different people, come up into consciousness and into daily use. And the little infant, as it grows up after a time with the knowledge that he or she is just precisely he or she. And by self-reference, the word I is used. By reference to others, the word you is used. Our vijnana, or discriminative consciousness, on the dissolution of the specific khandhas, the five aggregates of shape, feeling, thoughts, and so on, you know all about that. On the dissolution of the aggregates, which is when one is dead, properly dead, fully dead, these five khandhas constitute the existential self. Each of us here, as he is an existent being. And this is the existential self, which is manifest in the world as such. It is the mayavik, the illusory us. The illusory me or I. this vijnana, the discriminative consciousness which recognizes this as such, loses its finite existentiality as a separate entity or being and is completely absorbed into the one infinite non-being. Now please note, it is the I am I consciousness vanishes altogether. But the vijnana is completely absorbed into the one infinite non-being. It is not destroyed, but it is absorbed into it. Now the meaning of the word absorption we must be clear about. You know, one of the big criticisms and revulsions which the strictly and narrowly theistic theologian feels for the Upanishadic teaching about becoming completely one with Brahman and one's particular individuality is completely gone. They don't like that idea at all. They like to hold on to the idea that there is a permanent, everlasting fellowship with God as an identifiable entity. So they say this lost in Brahman is a disagreeable teaching. But oneself, like a freshwater individual stream, which is an identifiable dynamic entity, is now the ocean. It has ceased to be an identifiable entity. It has ceased to be fresh water, but has the salty savor of the immeasurable ocean. But it doesn't remain as the identifiable fresh water of the river as such. It is part of that ocean. It is completely absorbed in that ocean. And remember that it is each of us as a freshwater stream who dissolves the salts out of the earth as we journey to the ocean. The river dissolves the salts from the earth as it journeys to the ocean. And it is these salts which give the savor to the ocean. This must be borne in mind carefully. Now, in the case of ourselves as human beings, to put the analogy in a more concrete, exact form, what are these salts? If each of us is a stream of life, what are these salts which we extract out of the earth as we journey to the ocean? They are the qualities and the essences of all our experience in life. And these essences and qualities are what we contribute to the totality. And the totality, therefore, bears the impress of it all and has the savor of it all according as we have lived now. So you see, that means that each one of us is affecting the one total reality, use any word you like, God or Brahman or a theistic word or a non-theistic word, it doesn't matter. But we have changed that in the course of our living and our life. And this is what we give on our death to the totality. In this sense, we live, but unidentifiably. We can no longer be John Smith or William Brown. And yet we have made that contribution. Now if we see this see this clearly, we will be able to appreciate our individual worth, our individual use in the universal scheme of things. Because we are free agents within limits, of course. We are free agents to make our contribution. We can choose between the good and the evil. This comes out most strongly in the Zarathustrian teachings, in the Gathas. You will find it distinctly stated that the creative power brought man into being, endowing him with two kinds of mind. One mind, but with two potentialities. The potentiality for evil and the potentiality for good. And man's responsibility is to make the right choice. So you see, that is our great responsibility. We have to make the right choice. And therefore, if we see that each of us, like a river reaching the ocean, is absorbed into the one infinite total being as such, then if we have made the right choice, that infinite total being is enriched with the power for good. There is nothing lost, therefore, in the whole process. Like the scientific principle of the conservation of mass and energy, it seems as if in the spiritual sense, and I should say the psychological sense also, the whole psycho-spiritual sense and the psycho-spiritual process, there is this extraordinary conservation of the creative power which starts up the universe, maintains it, and reabsorbs it. So, oneself, the infinitely tiny being, a speck only of man dust, is a contributor to the infinite transcendence, and the eternal immortal God is the creator of each one of us by expressing, by squeezing a fragment of its own self out of the one total non-being state into the particular being state. It's important to be able to appreciate this with some sort of wideness and depth. If we do, we will find ourselves become free of the conflict between self-conceit on the one hand and the wrong sort of self-depreciation on the other hand. Also, thousands of people who have this awful struggle inside themselves, what use am I in the world? I am doing nothing at all. I'm no use at all. Look at so and so fulfilling a purpose of existence. There is none for me, and so forth. All that nonsense would disappear. And for example, supposing the mothers of the great artistic and scientific and philosophical geniuses and so on felt that sort of feeling, what use am I? Well, Without them, where would Beethoven or Shakespeare or anyone have been? The world would be that much poorer, wouldn't it? So there is no good saying, what is the use of me? Or I only have sort of drudged and born children and wasted my life. Wasted my life? You see, the little concept of my life and my existence, if that is once out And this interaction and interrelationship with the totality is appreciated in its tremendous significance. Then life becomes full of an inward joy which can always absorb the external sorrow and difficulty and so on, pain and whatever it is that comes to us, and transform it into wisdom, into understanding, and then one can always be helpful to other human beings who are in difficulty. Helpful not because one can speak to them, or not only because one can speak to them or write about these things, but by one's very presence the other person is helped. And because there is a living rapport, and a rapport which is held within a transcendent context and not a limited context. So, if we see this, we can also see that samsara, maintained by tanha, the clinging to existence, culminates in nirvana, and nirvana generates samsara for the sheer joy of discovering the measureless bliss of its own ultimate reality. We as we are, unenlightened, confused, fearful, and dominated by tanha, do not, because we cannot, see death as other life. This is the real obstructiveness of tanha, this clinging to life. And by life, we are so short-sighted that we associate life with just what is actually present as such. We don't want to let it go. If it is agreeable to us, if it is disagreeable to us, then we can be an awful nuisance both to ourselves and to those around us. But we do not see death as other life. And if we do sort of respond to the idea of death as other life, we respond to it in the mistaken way of thinking that it is the other life for me, the unchanging, permanent, identifiable entity, which is the mistake. Death as other life is something which is quite extraordinary. We invent heavens, hells, and future lives in a hereafter for our continuance as existential beings, separate and isolative. We fail to see the simultaneity of birth and death. Now this, of course, is extremely difficult to see, but if we can appreciate the lifespan of at the atomic level, we shall see that the generation of a subatomic particle and its reabsorption or its interaction with other subatomic particles and thereby its disappearance only to give rise to new particles takes place at speeds which are inconceivable to us. The human brain cannot imagine these things. 100 millionth of a second, even less sometimes. They call them nanoseconds, 10^-15 of a second. Ridiculously small amount. 1,000,000,000,000th of a second. I don't think we can ever make a watch or a clock, even an atomic clock, which will really register these appallingly small dimensions. But if the mind, if the brain will stay quiet and let the mind gradually respond to the reality of time, the reality of time in the sense that it is the rhythm of the living process of the universe, then something quite extraordinary happens. You begin to get, begin to feel a rapport, a certain at-homeness with the infinitely small. And it is particularly valuable this way, that it makes one appreciate one's own smallness in the totality of the cosmos. And yet, one also can appreciate, therefore, one's tremendous importance, that this speck of man dust, as I call it, oneself, is capable of responding to such immensities in both directions, the direction of smallness and the direction of bigness. It's a wonderful thing. See what marvelous people we are, marvelous creatures we are, and that's a fact, we are really quite marvelous. If we can appreciate that at a small level, then we shall be able to understand, really to understand, and not just hold it as a string of words, the simultaneity of life and birth and death. And it all comes within the grasp of the eternal life, which is both the source, the origin, the background, and the bringer to an end of all manifestation. The disruption of structure, the cessation of the bodily processes manifest to our physical senses is what we call death. The countless forms or bodies in and through which life displays itself all die. Life form dies, but life function goes on. Function is one, unitary and whole. Structure is multitudinous. In us human beings, life function displays grades of consciousness. Life forms, by their death, manifest self-transcending, ultimately releasing the different beings, the separate I am I's, into the universal non-being or supreme being, the one and only I am. So, Sri Krishna said, being and non-being am I, O Arjuna. That's one of the most worthwhile sentences in the Gita to meditate upon. Meditate upon that as much as you can. It's an extraordinary, it'll be a source of remarkable revelation. Being and non-being am I. The present tense, am, means I as I am existing now. I am both being and non-being. And the non-being is the one total reality. Non-being can only be one, it can't be many. Beings can be multitudinous. But to be simultaneously the finite, temporal and mortal, as well as the infinite, eternal and immortal, that is the miracle of our existence. It's an extraordinary thing. But you see, we are so blind to all that. We are just quite ignorant of it. When a Buddha or someone like that talks about ignorance being at the root of ignorance and tanha being at the root of difficulty and so forth, how profound is the teaching? And it's very interesting that he starts with ignorance, avidya, avidya. And do remember that ignorance does not mean just what it means in the English language, not knowing your algebra or whatever it is. It doesn't mean that, but it means not seeing. Avidya, with the root with means to see, and to see means to see in the sense of seeing so clearly that you are what you see in consciousness. You are in consciousness and mind just what you actually see. And when you see like that, then you are truly conscious of that. And that is manifested in your daily life naturally and spontaneously. You don't have to think about it, you don't have to recollect it. It just functions naturally as such. And it's the same with the different spiritual values. Where there is true love, the Mahakaruna, the great compassion, where there is that in its actuality, then you don't have to try to be compassionate. You are naturally compassionate all the time. You can't avoid it. And that is being that which you see. And that is the nature of the real consciousness of the great spiritual values. It's an unknowing knowing. So, Sri Krishna said, being and non-being am I, O Arjuna. The disorganizing of each particular organism by death opens the way to a self-organism of a more evolved character, an autopoietic process. Autopoietic, poiesis in Greek means organizing or forming. And this is a self-organizing process. Now this is of extreme importance. It would be difficult to find even 100 human beings in the whole world who appreciate the fact that all of us as individuals live through a process of self-organization. And yet each and every cell which composes our body manifests that. You know, the three of the fundamental characteristics of the living cell are self-motivation, self-reproduction, and self-healing. What does self-healing mean? It is a reorganizing of all the substance of the cell in such a manner that the cell is a healthy, living organism as such. Doesn't it? This power of self-healing. And this power is inherent throughout the universe in every single manifested existence, whether it be an inert thing or whether it be a living thing. If we are in, so that is the meaning of autopoietic, self-organizing. Again, that emphasizes our personal responsibility and our personal involvement with the total world process. All this is strongly emphasized. If we are intelligent, if we are mindfully perceptive, we would see death as the means for relinquishing whatever holds us back from true spiritual progress, whatever holds us back from the transformation of our present existing mode of awareness into a profounder mode and into a more intense consciousness of our growing process and of the actuality present here now. We are not intensely conscious of the actuality here now. That is largely because we are so self-preoccupied. And that's where our brains act as Mephistopheles, always concerned with ourselves, what we wish, what we desire, what we want, and so forth and so forth. Thy will, not mine, is just a phrase. It is my will and my will over again. Such progressive change purifies the psyche, and this in turn allows for further transformation, till at last the heart glows with compassion, and the wisdom and goodness and beauty of the divine mind, of the Buddha nature, of the Christ consciousness, flood one's whole being and spread benediction over the world around. Enshrined in the divine mind is Ritta, the eternal order which lies at the heart of all things and beings in the cosmos. This power is essentially moral. It is an energy which makes all things pure and perfect and holy. Our moral imperative derives from Ritta. In the Rig Veda, the very form of one of the gods, Varuna, the first of the Rig Vedic gods, and he is the moral governor of the universe, the very form of Varuna is declared to be Ritta itself. It's a lovely artistic way of presenting a profound truth. When each one of us, as the existential mortal, has become embodied virtue, the divine virtue in which are gathered all the supreme excellences, the paramitas of Mahayana teaching, then indeed each one of us is the fulfilled human in the supreme sense, the true Son of Man.